We are complex beings, and it's not any one thing, but there's a subset of emotions and there's a subset of primal urges that influence a large variety of people in their decision making. And that's what I'm getting down to there. And then when we start talking about the social influences, I can't emphasize that more because social influences really, really drive buying behavior. We know that there's an enormous amount of data around it.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, we're going to have a great discussion today because we're going to get down and focus in on some things that oftentimes are just forgotten. And when I think about these things that oftentimes we forget because we get stuck in task mode, we get stuck in strategy building mode, these things are really the differentiators that will help you to stand out and really connect with your prospects and, quite frankly, your existing customers. And to help us in that is going to be the author of Primal Storytelling, Marketing for Humans, Anthony L. Butler. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Jim. I appreciate you having me on.
Now, you and I have actually had some great discussions prior to this. I'm hoping that all of that will enrich in what we're going to talk about today. But before we get into that, if you could just tell the B2B DM gang just a little bit about your background so that we can use it as a foundation starting point.
So I kind of have an odd background, very untraditional education. Coming out of high school, I enlisted in the Army as a mechanic and spent a few years as enlisted. And then every year, West Point takes just a few enlisted guys. I was one of those. And then I spent 4 years at the academy. And then I was commissioned an infantry officer. And I was an infantry officer for about 9 years. And then after the Army, I found myself in a startup world, and I happened to have a little bit of luck, and I was part of a startup that had a nine-figure exit. And when I started the startup, when I started at the startup, I wasn't the founder. I was like employee number 40 or so. When I left, there were over 500 of us, and it was a really good learning experience because I got to help create all of the stories around the service and around the business and like how we were connecting with audiences. And I was on the sales team. They didn't have a lot of money for marketing. So we had to kind of work on that as we went. And then flash forward a few years, a few other jobs, and I founded a marketing agency, Can Do Ideas. And that's what I've been doing for the last 9 years. So yeah, it's been really fun.
Well, I mean, as you're talking and explaining even that, I start thinking about, first of all, it had to be, I mean, you know, like your son, you know, to be enlisted, you know, and get selected to go into West Point. I mean, that in itself is exceptional. When you start talking about being part of a team to grow, you know, an organization and be part of that and be in the sales group and having to do market. I mean, those are all exceptional and unique things that I start thinking about some of the things that I know in regards to military, a strategy, military focus, military, you know, execution. I could see a whole lot of elements coming into play on what, you know, how you've been able to have that success. But it all started from you being, you know, selected out of probably tens of thousands of people to go to West Point. I mean, did they ever, so what were the insights and things that they shared in regards to why you were selected for that?
Well, it's a long story on why I even applied. But it came down to, I had and I still, to a certain extent, have a knack for shooting. And when I had got stationed in Germany and I was working at a nuclear unit, the Army used to have tactical nuclear weapons. And I got this additional duty where I had to go to this NATO base and work at a rifle and pistol range for NATO. And so you had all of these different NATO countries going there and qualifying with their weapons. So different machine guns and rifles and pistols and things. And so I lived at that range for months and months and months. You know, and I grew up shooting. I'm from Montana. I grew up here. I've been shooting my entire life pretty much. And one day I was at the range and I shot. So just so you understand, you have unlimited ammunition. You have all these different kinds of weapons. And so I was at that range for weeks and months, and I shot all the weapons and I could really shoot. And so there was this German colonel who ran the range and he was responsible for it. And there'd be certain people who came in, he knew couldn't shoot very well. And so he would have me sit in this lane on the far end and kind of knock down some of their targets from like 150 meters across all the lanes. And so what went on was, one day I'm out there and I'm shooting, and there was this American officer who was there, and he'd heard about what I was doing and he saw me shooting, and he came up to me and he's like, you know what? I was the captain of the pistol rifle team at West Point. He's like, you would be great there. They would love you. And West Point, for a long time, they had this Olympian who was the coach, and this guy named Majunkin, and he was Olympian. And so anyway, they wanted me to go to the pistol team. And so, but I wasn't super awesome at all my tests. And, you know, West Point's really competitive to get into. They only accept, you know, a fraction of people who apply. And so I ended up applying to the prep school. And the way how the prep school works is, you know, thousands of applications, they accept about 100 or so enlisted every year. And then of those 100, they take 30 or 40, just depending on the year. But you also have to get, you have to go for like a congressman or a senator or a vice president to sponsor you to go. So while I was there, I passed, I won the competition there, and I made it in.
Well, okay. So again, you and I've had conversations. So as you're telling that story, and I start, you know, looking at the things and discussions that we've had, and you know, what you have shared in Primal Storytelling, it starts making sense. It starts making sense from the perspective of, you know, connecting down to that human level, the relationships, all of those things that were so important to you being able to, you know, essentially have, you know, some exceptional results, you know, and it, for you, it obviously seems like it came quite naturally. For others, others of us, not so much. So I think it's really important for us to talk about, what is primal storytelling?
So what primal storytelling is at its heart is a business marketing system. And what I'm trying to help businesses do is have a way to create an audience and then monetize that audience through storytelling. Now why did I choose storytelling? Where does that even come from? It's like, you look online right now and the internet is just flooded with content from businesses. Okay. And most of it is terrible. Most of it is just absolute nonsense. You just would never read it. You know, there's a giant graveyard of corporate blogs that no one has ever read. And then if you did try to read it, you're like, who is this for? Like, why would I read that? It's a cure for insomnia. Okay. It's just terrible. But the problem that you're running into is there's 1.5 billion websites. So every small business in America is going online and they're trying to get some attention. And it's just really hard. It's the most competitive environment online that we've ever had. And what I realized just a couple of years into running this agency is that companies that create structure around their marketing that's aligned with storytelling, that's aligned with some storytelling structures, they do much better. They grow more audiences. They generate way more leads. They're able to have a much more authentic kind of sales process when they do connect with someone, because then they're the experts. They've created a connection. They've shown and started to grow some trust, you know, and it's not a single act. It's just a whole bunch of different things all together, you know, and you mentioned the military background. One thing about the Army, I was a blue collar guy the whole time I was there. You know, I was a mechanic as enlisted and I was in the infantry, is that the Army's ran by checklists. I don't know if you know this. Everything's checklist. I got to do all these things. Check, 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 check. I got it all done. And I was like, okay, I'm running a small business and I want to do good marketing. Is there a way I can simplify that and basically create a checklist and a structure? And so when I was writing the book, I was like, okay, if this meathead, if I'm going to implement my own strategy, it's got to be really simple and straightforward. I want anyone to be able to pick up that book and be able to say, okay, I'm going to create this process within my business and I'm going to implement it like this. And so that's what the book is about and where it came from.
Well, okay. And that's critically important in a couple of different ways, but it goes back to what I had said earlier is we can checklist things all we want, but if the quality and the focus of that checklist is, you know, does not generate, you know, the outcome that we want, that's where the problem is. Cause I mean, I can create checklists all day long. So yep. One of the things that you say is you say that primal urges are the vestiges of human instincts that are nearly extinct, but still influence human behavior. What does that mean?
So think about geese. Geese fly south for the winter. It's genetically encoded behavior, something they have to do. They don't fly east, they don't fly west, they don't go on vacation to Hawaii, okay? Humans, we still have the vestiges of genetically coded behavior in ourselves, but we have free will. We've overcome those instincts. There's nothing that we have to do anymore, okay? So like as an example, everybody wants to be part of a tribe. That's why we have such close connections with family. If you like the UN and a lot of other agencies, they've done all kinds of research. If you put someone in isolation for long periods of time, they literally go crazy. They've said that long periods of isolation is actually torture. Well, one of the primal urges that we have that's overarching, it's one of the most important urges, is our need for tribe. And almost all buying behavior is influenced by what we think other people will think of us when we buy something. The clothes we wear, the food that we eat, the car that we drive, the house, the neighborhood, everything, all of these decisions, yeah, they may have some logic behind them and they definitely, you know, that's part of it. But emotionally and deep down, one of our primal urges are the social signals we're sending to everyone. You know, like, why aren't I wearing a clown mask right now and, you know, and a yellow hat and a big bright suit? Well, it's not me. It's not what I deep down feel like the audience will need to feel that I'm a credible person. And when you look across to when you meet someone new, how they present themselves really matters. It's a social signal piece. And that's a primal urge that, yeah, can I choose to dress differently? I can. And it's a personal choice, but it also has a lot to say about who my groups are and who I'm influenced by and who I care about.
Well, and I would even add, because I mean, okay, that's one aspect and element. And the other aspect yep. element is, you know, and going back to what I would mention as far as, you know, what I had learned as far as, you know, military strategy, part of the military strategy going back into the, I think, 1980s, is they started talking about how do I make decisions and take the right actions when I have a VUCA environment. And VUCA is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And when we start thinking about, you know, the business to business world, that's exactly where we live right now. When we start talking about right now, you talk about the 1.5, you know, billion sites, but yeah. Actually over 7 billion blogs. So, and oh, yeah. Over, you know, 3 plus, you know, million or 4 million podcasts. I mean, I can now, with the help of, you know, some of these AI tools and what's to come, you know, do push button, you know, marketing, do push button, you know, blog. I mean, all of that stuff is just going to mean that we're actually just at the very, you know, beginning stages of what's going to be a hockey stick growth. In regards to all this content that's out there. So what we're talking about is going to become more challenging than ever. So, if I start thinking about making decisions as a person who has to now help my organization go forward, I'm heavily, you know, looking at peers, heavily looking at those people who have similar responsibilities and trying to figure out what is they're doing, because we have a VUCA world that we have to move forward in.
So you've hit the nail exactly. It's not going to get easier because there's not going to be any reduction in content online. So what does that mean? It means that if you are using ChatGPT or some other AI tool, there's a whole bunch of them just coming out of the woodwork right now. Okay. I've got to start thinking bigger about what I'm going to do. What can I do that the AI cannot? And one of the things that none of the AI right now is good at is making what we think of as loose connections. Okay. So think about the three core ideas behind primal storytelling. So on one side, you've got evolutionary psychology. And then I link that with storytelling structures. And then on the third part, I was like, okay, and how do these two things apply to modern day marketing? And that's not something that any AI can do because they're very, very loose ideas, and I connect them together in what I hope is a holistic manner that someone can use. So when I go to a company, I'm saying, okay, let's create something new. Let's create something that's not being done anywhere else. It's why I think I mentioned it in the book. It's like if another brand goes on Twitter and starts promoting pithy quotes of the day or sharing the news of their industry, it's like, I just want to gouge out my eyes. It's like the worst marketing. It's just such a waste of time. You know, how many people how many quotes do you see on social media right now? And that's the only purpose is just to be part of a conversation and post a quote. Well, that's not worth anything to anyone because everyone is doing it. It's just more noise. It's noise, noise, noise. So we want to create meaningful content.
Okay. So then even talking about getting lost in the mire and the muck in the fog is storytelling. And just looking at storytelling for selling and marketing, it's like there's, you know, how many millions of returns are we going to get if we do that type of searching? So, I mean, we can go back and kind of turn back the dial and say that, you know, Donald Miller and the Story Brand, you know, concepts, you know, kind of brought this to light, you know, in 15 years ago or plus. And so now we've seen all these different variations of it. I mean, so what's Donald, about primal?
So Donald Miller and Story Brand, I love it. It's really good stuff. It's about creating taglines and very, very clear marketing messages for the front end. Okay. That's not what I'm talking about at all. What I'm talking about is producing long tail content over a very long period of time that helps you build the original audience that's coming to your website. So you take Story Brand, you apply that to your website, you have a clear message, you've got clear calls to action, you know, all the basics of marketing. He does a good job of that. Okay. And I think one of his core messages is, hey, make the customer the hero. And I completely agree with it. And I would take nothing away from that. Primal storytelling starts where Donald stops, is what's next. So they come to our website, they don't buy. Maybe they sign up for our email list. Maybe I have a lead magnet. Maybe I want to grow my audience on social media so that I have a larger audience that I can talk to. Well, how do I actually do it? How you connect with a large audience is you tell a story. If you go on Instagram and look at any of the largest followings of any celebrity out there, okay, and just scroll through their Instagram and ask yourself the question, what stories are they trying to tell? Whether you love them or hate them, Kim Kardashian and all the sisters, Kylie Jenner and all the rest of them, go and just scroll through their Instagram. And they're saying basically the same story, all of them. It's basically fairy tale princess who grew up and got rich, and now she's out in the world and she's living this wonderful life. And if you follow them, you can live vicariously through them in their life. Okay. In olden times, what did we know about kings and queens and princesses and princes? Why were so many stories focused on that? Well, today, at least in the United States, we don't really have royalty anymore. Instead, we have celebrities. And people want to live that bigger life. And so that story that they're seeing, this life's journey, that is something that is incredible to most people. You know, it's why all of the pictures and videos of people flying privately on jets in these big, you know, in living in castles and these massive houses and, you know, living these crazy lives is that it's so popular because it's tapping into what has always been interesting to people.
All right. But with that, you say that marketers, it's important to understand that the delivery mechanism, whether it's a website, social media, email, print, video, or audio, doesn't change people's expectation of the message.
Yeah, that's right.
What does that mean?
So what it means is technology has changed dramatically last 100 years. And in the book, I use the example of my grandfather, Charles Butler. Okay. Charles Butler was born in the 1890s. Okay. I actually was able to meet him and go to where he was born and, you know, see his ranch. Well, when he was born at home with a house that was literally made by hand with the same technology we had during Roman times. Okay. And in his lifetime, he went from, you know, basically the same technology we've had for thousands and thousands of years to this entire technological revolution in a single life, a single generation. So he experienced, like he remembered when indoor plumbing was a luxury. You know, he remembered his house getting wired up for electricity when radio came out. It was like really exciting. And then he remembered when TV came out, the microwave oven, you know, and then he saw the space shuttle and computers all in one life. And now, but what didn't change? Charles didn't change. He was the same man who was born on that house out in the woods. Okay. My point with that is that our technology has changed far faster than human nature has changed. If you take a baby from 2000 years ago and you had a time machine and you brought them forward, they would be swiping and playing on their iPad just like every other kid today, just as fast as they would. There's no difference. Okay. We haven't changed. And so what I'm saying by that is that the messages are the same. The medium is different. Our reaction to what we buy is still the same. We're still buying for the same reasons as our ancestors did. You know, we have all the same things that everybody else wants. Like one of the things I learned, you know, I went to over 20 countries when I was in the Army, you know, and I spent 2.5 years in different danger zones and war zones around the world. And it's very interesting is that every country you go to, there's just these massive commonalities in cultural things that you have in every society. Every society has music. Okay. There's no one who ever said, I don't love music. Like as a society, there's always someone who loves music. It's part of every society. Dancing is part of every society. Cuisine, food of some sort is part of every society. There's always a religion of some sort. Okay. There's anthropologists have found, you know, more than 5,000 religions going all the way back through time. Not a single society without religion. It's a primal urge for humans to want to experience the divine in some way. Okay. As a marketer, when I start to understand these commonalities on what makes us human and realize that they haven't changed, just the technology is a little different. So it makes it much easier to create messages that really ring. Because then your head is not full of, oh, well, this is a blog, so I should be really formal on here. Oh, this is a video for Facebook. Oh, that should be, you know, I should really have good branding on that. Like, no, brand is not what, you know, brand color is not connecting with an audience. Like what's connecting with an audience is a message that you can help them.
Let's make that a little bit like you were saying, checklist and simple for people to understand. And we refer to three driving forces of human behavior, and that we always need to consider these. And I think that's you've kind of talked about that, but let's make them really clear. Those three driving forces of human behavior are primal urges, emotions, and social influences. So I think what you're saying is that we need to make sure that we're applying those because they're universal.
That's exactly right. So I outline what primal urges are more likely or not to help influence buying decisions. Okay. And I also, I break down the emotions, you know, how many emotions are there? there's dozens and dozens of them. We don't really experience pure emotions at any given time. We experience, you know, a myriad of emotions all at once. So like my son has graduated from high school. I'm really excited. He's got this great accomplishment. I'm also kind of fearful he's going away for college and I'm going to miss him. And, you know, I'm going to feel sad about that. You know, like you have mixed emotions about just about everything. Is that we are complex beings and it's not any one thing, but there's a subset of emotions and there's a subset of primal urges that influence a large variety of people in their decision-making. And that's what I'm getting down to there. And then when we start talking about the social influences, I can't emphasize that more because social influences really, really drive buying behavior. We know that there's an enormous amount of data around it.
I mean, and so I think for us, it's really being able to draw the connections and the linkages going back. Now, this is where you start talking about, ideal customer profiles, personas, go-to-market strategies, and making sure that all that ticks and ties. But you talk about, as far as brand archetypes, that there's useful tools in creating perspectives for brand marketers. And you talk about five different archetypes, meaning the mentor, the ally, the hero, the herald, and the royal. So Are we supposed to take these three forces, driving forces of human behavior, and use it in all of these, or just a few, or one?
So I normally, when I'm helping a company implement this, I usually recommend to them they choose one or two of the archetypes. And then what we're going to do is, so my particular archetypes that I use for myself is I'm primarily mentor and ally. I help train marketers to implement storytelling strategies in businesses. Okay, that's one of the things I do. When I take that role, I'm the mentor. I'm just helping them grow a business. I'm helping them learn a skill that is going to help them throughout their life. When I'm helping a business do it, I'm their ally. I'm helping them accomplish a goal. Okay, I'm aligning with them in that way. And then what I'll do is I'll take the primal emotions and those urges that are personal to those leaders in the business. And then it's aligned with the growth of that business. And I'll help them start to understand, like, how could they could implement this? How hard will it be? How many resources will it take? And I actually map content to the top, middle, and bottom of the funnel of my business. And I do the same process for myself that I do for others. And like, when you start to think of storylines, say, okay, so Jim has a business and you want to market it. Well, what stories do you tell first and how do you tell them? What kinds of content? And like, what is going to be your position? I think the mistake that most businesses make is that they publish dry, information-laden, jargon-laden blogs that no one really wants to read. And because there's no story around it, there's no real connection, no one really wants to read it. It's like reading a dry textbook from your economics class in college. Like you don't want to read that.
So So are you saying that, so let's take the example of a technology company. Especially for me, you hear about people writing, technical copy. You start talking about, different aspects of marketing. You start talking about brand creation, brand generate. I mean, are you saying that all this is getting blurred, or I have to go back to what we're thinking about, or what we're talking about as far as, are they top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of funnel, or existing customer? And then that, now I start gearing, my approaches and my tactics and strategies from that perspective.
Yep. So strategy always comes before tactics. So what we're doing is we're creating an overarching strategy that I can apply to all four parts of our funnel. So that top of the funnel where we're creating stories that help people become aware of us, and then the middle of the funnel, they're aware. Maybe they have a problem and we're trying to convince them that we can help them solve their problem. And then the bottom of the funnel where we're demonstrating expertise, we're helping ease any concerns that they might have about working with us. And then obviously messaging to our current clients. Okay. So We're telling stories to all four segments for different reasons with different purposes. And, you know, maybe the positioning is a little bit different in each of those. And it's funny you mentioned IT services. I used to be the CEO of an IT company in New York City. And when I left, when I first started this agency, I primarily focused on IT services companies. And every one of those companies makes a very similar mistake. And they're blogging about the newest virus that's out there and why you got to manage IT and this and that. And like, no one cares about any of that. Like, no one even wants to read it. You know, you're the office manager of a local small business. You don't want to read a blog about the newest virus that might destroy your business. That's not that strategy is not helping those companies get business. Instead, you flip it around and you start to find a niche. Maybe you create a thought leadership program that is for your specific niche that is going to help you connect with local leaders. Okay. It's a very, very simple strategy you can do. You know, maybe I did one for a big manufacturing company out in Long Island. And I think I mentioned this one in the book. And they were trying to connect with mechanical engineers that were coming out of college. And so this is a really giant, giant company. And, you know, they had lots of many different branches within their business, and they had done a lot of acquisitions. But one of the commonalities across all of their business lines was that engineers would recommend their product or recommend that these big companies buy their service. And then there would be a professional buyer that would come, and the professional buyer would, you know, negotiate the deal and that kind of thing. Okay. Well, they realized in a lot of these business lines, the engineers they were working with were engineers they've been working with for decades. Some of the engineers were 60 years old, 70 years old. And they're like, wait a minute. If these guys retire, no one's going to recommend us. We need to connect with the younger engineers, the young engineers that are coming out of college and like they want to be professional engineers. And like, so we looked at all their data and we did some surveys and we came up with this idea. It was like, what if we created a leadership development program that's targeted at graduated engineers? So the moment they graduate, they can't recommend your product, but we can start to make them aware of you by helping them in their career. So we help them learn how to run meetings. We help them, you know, learn to become a manager. We help them with their soft skills, because what do we know about mechanical engineers? You know, a lot of times they are not the most energetic people person. So we just help them with some soft skill stuff. And though that campaign was really successful, you know, thousands and thousands of downloads and connections. And now a few years into the program, some of the guys that they connected with years ago, know who they are now in positions where they can refer and recommend, and they're much more likely to make the decision to work with them. You know, it's a long-term strategy. Okay. What I can tell you is strategy beats tactics over time. I can have short-term tactics and they might work for the short term, but if I don't have an underlying strategy long-term, you know, I can't plan to win.
Well, I think you, talking about hitting a nail on the head, I think you just hit one on the nail hit on the head when you start talking about the separation and the issues associated with, you know, the silos of sales and marketing within organizations. And so what are now a lot of organizations doing? Doing away with chief marketing officers and creating chief growth officers, or creating chief revenue officers and trying to be able to bridge that gap. But part of it is what you're referring to, that sales is today driven, you know, and marketing is trying to meet that need, but then also think about the long term. And so you get this
right
dichotomous relationship that just creates a whole lot of strife.
That's exactly right.
So you're coming in and trying to bridge that as well, and then also helping organizations with it. Look, yes, you need to make a sale today. And quite frankly, when you're starting to talk about B2B high ticket, that doesn't happen that way. You know, you even talked about one example talking about, you know, hey, we were dealing with these people in the business side and, oh, I get turned over to a professional buying group. How do you, you know, buying teams, decision teams, decision timelines, customer buying journeys. I mean, all of those things, talking about VUCA, you know, it's quite VUCA. So, I mean, can you give an example of a time, and maybe it's that going back to that CEO scenario and situation. I mean, how long did it take in order for that transformation to come place and put these things into play to where you now started seeing some consistency in regards to your growth and your revenue streams?
So with them, it took months because we had to do discovery. We had to understand like what, you know, what were the possibilities for a program. And then we had to agree on the program, and they, you know, they're a really big company and they got layers of bureaucracy to get through and lawyers want to look at stuff and, you know, but moving through all of that, how fast can a small business do it? I think small business can implement that kind of program pretty quickly. You know, I have a service that I do. I call it a Primal Storytelling Foundation. And what that is I work with a company. It takes about 6 weeks, you know, based on their availability. And we just go through and we look at, okay, who are your clients? Who do you love working with? Who is the actual audience? And now then we start thinking, what do we know about them? What kinds of content could we create over the long haul that would really speak to them? One of my best success stories is a hotel, family-owned hotel in the heart of New York City. And they don't have a lot of money, surrounded by the biggest brands in the whole world, who basically have endless dollars to spend. And, you know, they do very well. And they're number one in a whole bunch of categories in SEO, all by implementing Primal Storytelling consistently for years at a time. You know, like it's transformed their business because now they get a lot of direct traffic bookings that they wouldn't otherwise get. Like, how many hotels out there do you know who have lead magnets? I have very, very few that do it. These guys have thousands and thousands of downloads on their website, and those people stay at the hotel and they pay a lot of money to stay there. Okay. And, you know, it's just a very creative way of approaching content marketing, and any business can do it. I have yet to find a category where we haven't been able to do this. I actually just did it for a local construction company in Montana. You know, it's this company that specializes in concrete. You know, they dig foundations for houses, and they build walls, and they do like fancy fountains and all kinds of stuff for big mansions and things. And they wanted to be known, and they wanted to be found, and they wanted to be searchable. It's like, okay. And so we just started out with the origin story. We moved to their transformation story. We did their vision stories. And then we started saying, okay, well, what kinds of content are people searching for? And so then we started linking and said, okay, well, one of their most profitable services, and this is a funny one, is they dig septic tanks. So if you want to build a house out in the woods, like, you got to have a septic tank, right? And so they go there and they have this whole process where they dig a septic field in the tank and they implement it. Or if your septic field fails, they can go there and they can help you fix it, right? Big projects. And I was like, well, so we did the data analysis on the back end. And we said, well, if we just blogged about how painful it is to fix a septic field and how easy that hiring you guys is, we tell those stories, it'll be easy to get hired. And you know what? It's absolutely worked for them. You know, so on one side, you've got manufacturing and hospitality. On this side, you've got septic tanks and construction. It works. You know, it's a...
Well, I think, it goes back to where we kind of started is it all works because it's all going back to those three driving forces of human behavior, right?
That's exactly
it. Primal urges, emotions, and then social influences.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if I'm sitting here and I'm, you know, I'm somebody who has to, you know, go through some type of change process, because what we're doing right now isn't getting us what we need. I have, you know, requirements because, I mean, ultimately content needs to lead to conversions. And this is where a lot of marketers have struggled, and a lot of senior leaders are losing their positions, you know, because there is a lack of the ability to say this actually is generating and creating that. And so we're, you know, it's no longer, you know, clicks and shares and this, that, and the other, it's conversions. Is, you know, how do I go through to say, all right, we're not getting what we need. Where should I initially start and focus? Because we've got to do something different.
So the very first step is you must start with tribe. So the primal storytelling formula is tribe plus primal emotions and urges plus story, Okay, so we got to start with tribe. We have to know who we're marketing to. I would argue all of this controversy about Bud Light comes down to one core issue. The marketing manager putting together those campaigns did not understand who the client was. They didn't understand them on a human level. They had this idea, oh, we want to grow the audience. We're going to grow the audience into a new generation, okay? But what they did is they alienated the current client base by trying to reach out to a completely different group that had completely different interests and values and a whole bunch of other things. Now, it doesn't matter where you fall on either side of the controversy, is they have lost billions with a B because they didn't focus on the audience. So think about Harley Davidson, okay? And I love using Harley as an example because that is a brand. They don't need Tony Butler at all because they know exactly who their audience is. They've known who it always is. They know exactly what the messaging is. And right now you can go to any Harley rally out there and you're going to see people with tattoos of Harley Davidson on them, okay? What does that tell you? It tells you that the story that Harley has been telling for decades is basically the same story over and over and over again with the same themes. Freedom, patriotism, having fun with your friends, close-knit groups. And I think they've tried to distance themselves from gangland violence and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think it's gone mainstream. Is that it's just a cool thing to do to own a Harley and to ride on the open road with your friends and your family and your hot girlfriend, okay? And that has worked for them year after year, decade after decade. And there are few brands with as strong as a following as them. You know, and I would love for Primal Storytelling to have that kind of brand recognition as Harley, right? Where you get someone gets a Primal Storytelling tattoo. I'm not there yet. But the lesson for Bud Light and for everyone else out there is that if you ignore your core tribe and your core audience and you show that you don't even like them, I think that was the one most disturbing thing about that whole thing is that the marketing manager, she didn't like her clients and she was the head of the brand for Bud Light. Like who made that decision? It's a mistake. So that's where they're going to start. And then from there, all other things spring. What do your clients love? What is important to them? What are they afraid of? What are their fears? What are their driving emotions on why they might work with you or why they might not work with you? So like for instance, when I'm in a sales situation and someone is thinking about hiring me for implement Primal Storytelling in their business, okay? One of the first obstacles that I have to overcome is their reluctance to work with me because they don't know me. They're asking their question, well, if I hire Anthony, am I getting fired? Is he gonna blow up my business? He's gonna spend all my money and on Google Ads and we're not gonna get any return? Does this guy know what he's doing? Like you have all this, I call it head trash, where they're just thinking all of these things that have nothing to do with the deal, but has everything to do with their emotional drivers. You know, and so every business deals with this. And if you can map those out, like map out what those fears are, and then think of the stories that you can tell that will help overcome and help create a bond, because we want to do business with people we like. We want to do business with people we trust. We want to buy from people that, you know, have similar values. And you just can't market to someone that you hate. You just can't. Like, you're not going to be successful. If you don't love your clients, if you don't love working with them, you love serving them, you are not going to be successful. You're just not.
Well, and the other thing when you start even talking about that is that especially when you start, even when your reference was in a business to business environment, the bar of decision is higher, you know, because my reputation is on the line. Other people's, you know, money and investment is on the line. So, the requirement and the bar that you have to overcome, you know, is higher. The bigger ticket, the bigger the bar. And so that those primal connections become even more critical the more is at stake. So, yeah, exactly. Man, I'll tell you, great conversation, you know, getting back to some of the primal basics that have been there forever that, like you said, oftentimes we just forget. They're, like you said, they're not going away. They've been overshadowed by a lot of other things. But if we actually look with the right lens, we see these things exist everywhere, and including the failures like Bud Light. So, Anthony L. Butler, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
So I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I answer all my own messages. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. If you come to the website, primalstorytelling.com/podcast, there's a free gift there for you, for all the guests. There's, you can get a digital copy of the book and some bonuses. And just anthony@primalstorytelling.com.
Anthony, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Hey, thank you, Jim. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.